Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the shifting paradigm, really how we are coming into a new understanding of what it is to be a human being and what it means to be a full being, a full conscious, awake being in this changing world. So I thought it would be great to talk to someone who's really been at the forefront of change and civil rights and understanding the corporate structure and how we can deal with that in a new way and present new possibilities to the world. He's Daniel Sheehan, and he has been a public rights defender. He's a lawyer. He's done some amazing cases. He's worked on the Karen Silkwood case, the Watergate, Pentagon Papers. And in terms of what this program is about, he was the legal counsel for John Mack at Harvard when Harvard was very objected to John Mack talking about aliens in his book, Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. And he's going to be a keynote speaker at the Contact in the Desert coming up May 29th to the 31st in Joshua Tree, California. You can look at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center for more information about that. Danny, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alan. I appreciate being here.
Of course. And, you know, your perspective on the ET situation goes back to Jimmy Carter's days, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's the first time that I had any kind of official participation in the investigation of this particular phenomenon.
So were you into that before that, or did Jimmy Carter come to you and say, I want you to check this out? How did that come about?
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting. I was actually at a dinner with Rosemary Chalk, who was the executive secretary of the National Academy of Science. She happened to be a member of the Catholic community that I was part of when I was in Washington, D.C., as chief counsel for the Jesuit National Headquarters in Washington. And we were getting at the end of the dinner, and she commented, she said, you know, it's kind of extraordinary that you've done all of these different cases that, you know, all the way from the Watergate burglary case to the Pentagon Papers case to the case that established the right of journalists to protect their confidential news sources. And you must have been just a born lawyer. You must have just always wanted to be a lawyer ever since you were a kid. And I said, well, actually, that's peculiar because, no, I actually wanted to be an astronaut. And then I explained to her what had happened, that the appointment to the United States Air Force Academy, where I was going to go, had been given to the son of the mayor of Glens Falls, in our county, and I ended up going to Harvard College and going on to become an attorney. And she was kind of struck by that, and she said, "Holy mackerel!" She said, "You know, you actually are interested in being an astronaut. Why did you want to do that?" And I told her because I believed that there was extraterrestrial intelligence and that being an astronaut would enable me to participate in getting to go out and find these other beings. And she said, holy smokes, she said, you know, it turns out that one of my best friends, Marcia Smith, has just been, she's the head of the Science and Technology Committee of the United States Congressional Research Service. And she's been tasked by President Carter to prepare a major classified report to the president on two things. One, the various UFO phenomena, what the degree of probability is that any of them may be vehicles from an extraterrestrial civilization. And second issue was to determine what the probability is that there actually exists a highly technologically developed other intelligent civilization here in our galaxy that could reach us. And so she said, would you be willing to talk with her about this? Since you're the chief counsel at the Jesuit headquarters, that's a pretty impressive position. Would you be willing to talk with her? So I said, yes, I would. And Marcia called me, and I had lunch with her, and she invited me to become a special counsel to the investigation, the study that was being done for the president. And she asked me actually whether I would be able to see if we could get access to the Vatican Library in Rome to determine what type of information they might have in the restricted sections of the Vatican Library, reflecting the information that the church might have about either one of the two subjects, A, whether or not there was an extraterrestrial civilization, and B, whether or not any of the UFO vehicles might conceivably be vehicles from such a civilization. So I was more than happy to try to do that, so I went and talked to Father Bill Davis, who was my immediate supervisor at the Jesuit headquarters, and he got permission for me to contact the head of the Vatican Library, who happened to be a Jesuit. And I wrote a letter to him and explained what we were doing and asked him if he would give me access to the classified sections of the Vatican Library to take a look at this. And he wrote a letter back to me and said no. And so I was kind of taken aback, so I wrote a second letter to him saying, excuse me, you mustn't have understood, you know, who we are here. We're the Jesuit National Headquarters in the United States, and the president wants to have some of this information. I'd like to be able to get access to those portions of the library. And he wrote back and said, no. So I had to go and tell Marcia that, much to our mutual disappointment, I wasn't going to be getting access to this. And so she then contacted me, must have been a couple of weeks or a few weeks later. And she told me that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the SETI program out in Pasadena, California, the Congress had cut out half of their budget. This is 1977, the fiscal year for that. And she wanted to know whether I'd be willing to go with one or more of the astronauts to go and meet with sort of key members of the Congress to see if we could get the budget reinstated for SETI. And I was happy to do that, and I checked with my superiors at the Jesuit office, and they agreed to let me do that. So I went with Rusty Schwab and a few others, and we went around to the Congress people, and the Congress ended up putting back the other half of the budget for SETI. And so the top 50 scientists at SETI, out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, were ecstatic, and they invited me to do a three-hour closed-door seminar to them on the theological implications of contact with an extraterrestrial civilization. So I got back to Marcia, who was still engaged in doing this study, and I said, look, if you want me to do this talk to the scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on this subject, could you see during the process of doing your research, could you potentially get me access to the classified portions of Project Blue Book that was undertaken by the United States Air Force back in the 50s? And she said, I don't think that they'll let us get access to that, but I said, look, there's no harm in asking. See if you can get them to agree to do it. And so she did. She contacted them in her official capacity as the chief of the director of the Science and Technology Division of the United States Congressional Research Service and asked if I could, as a special counsel to their study, get access to this. And to her surprise and mine, they said yes. And so so I ended up actually getting to be given access. They actually brought to Washington the sets of files that were classified still at that time and brought them to the new wing of the Library of Congress that hadn't even been opened yet. It was brand new. It was called the Jefferson Building or something, but it was brand new. Nobody was even in it, and I was invited to come over there on a Saturday morning and prove who I was with my ID and everything, and was given access to these files. And I actually saw in the files photographs of, you know, undisputable evidence of these vehicles and the different ones that had been photographs taken, etc. And one of them was a clear photograph of a classic UFO with, you know, must have been 100 feet in diameter, and a big dome on the top of it, and it was crashed. It had actually hit into this snow-covered field somewhere, and it had plowed this great big gouge across the field, and it was stuck in the side of an embankment, sticking up at like a 45-degree angle. And there were all kinds of Air Force personnel all gathered around it in these big parkas with camera equipment and stuff, taking photographs and stuff of it. And it was a piece of microfiche film, and I had it on one of those overhead microfiche machines, and so I'd been told that I couldn't take any notes or anything, but I happened to have with me a yellow pad, even though they insisted that I check my briefcase outside the door, and I did, but I had this yellow pad with me and a pen. So I basically slipped it under the microfiche machine and focused the picture onto the inside hardback cover of the yellow pad, because there were these symbols that were on the base of the dome that was on this UFO. And one of the photographs they had of it was close enough so I could see the symbols on it. And so I wanted to make sure I had them exactly correct. So what I did is I literally shone the photograph down onto the inside back cover of the cardboard backing of the notepad, and I traced the exact symbols. And when I got all done doing it, I realized that since they told me I wasn't supposed to do that, I was going, oh no, I better get out of here with this thing. So I still this day kick myself over it, because I could have stayed in there a lot longer and looked at a whole bunch of different stuff, and it sounds completely stupid. I mean, here I am, you know.
Well, do you still have those symbols?
Didn't get it.
Do you still have the symbols that you've traced?
Yes.
Because, you know, I was talking to Jesse Marcel the third last week, yes, talking about the symbols that his father and his grandfather also saw on a UFO craft, and they also compared it to what Jim Pendison saw in the Rendlesham Forest landing. So I wonder if
they were actually with Jesse Marcel that what his grandfather saw. They were on these little those little lightweight I don't know what they were. They're like some kind of little sticks that were part of the debris that were there. They had these little strange symbols on them, but those were not anything like the ones I saw. The symbols that were on the actual lower section of the dome of this particular UFO that I saw were different. They didn't look like those at all.
It would be interesting, though, to collect all the symbols that people have seen, and they may be craft from different places, of course.
Yes.
But it'd be just great to see them all together somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, I remember what they all look like, but it turns out we were digging through all of my records at the Jesuit headquarters. And I got to keep some of the records when I left Jesuit headquarters. But we've searched high and low for these things. There's a whole bunch of our files got water on them when we had them stored. And in fact, folks were from the Disclosure Project came to my office last week. We were all searching around through these things to see if I could find these things. I know what they look like, but the problem is that my general recollection of what they look like isn't identical to exactly what they were. And the reason I traced them is so they were completely identical, you know, in the order in which they appeared, which probably means something. But I did see them, so I was positive that this was. Well, it was clearly a UFO vehicle, and based upon the way that the U.S. Air Force people were acting, that were all gathered all around it, it certainly wasn't just one of our craft. I mean, that there were probably half a dozen photographs of this thing, and I mean they had movie cameras and everything taking pictures of it.
What year do you think that photograph was taken?
I don't know. I don't know. I saw it. It must have been February, March or of 1977 when I saw it. But it was an older, they were older pictures because the kind of cameras that the one camera, one of the cameras I could see was one of those cameras that got, it has the two great big round things on top of it where, like, you know, like the, you know, when you saw King Kong, the movie, that they were lugging that camera around, they had the big camera rolls on the top of it, the big film rolls. So this is probably something in the 50s or something.
Yeah, probably. But whatever happened, did you ever get to see Jimmy Carr and say, guess what, there's all these files and they're undercover?
No, what I did is I communicated the information to Marcia Smith, you know, who was the one doing the thing. And then she prepared a... She prepared two separate classified reports. One was on the probabilities of the existence of one or more highly technologically developed intelligent civilizations inside our galaxy, and came to the conclusion that it was more than 95% probable that there were from 2 to 6 at least highly technologically developed other intelligent civilizations that were non-human civilizations just in our galaxy alone, the Milky Way galaxy. And there are 500 billion trillion galaxies, you know, but she was directing her attention specifically to the Milky Way galaxy. And then she also prepared a classified report to the president on the different types of UFO vehicles that had been reported in a credible manner, and in that case, all there has to be is one of them that is actually from an extraterrestrial civilization. If any one of them is, then that settles the issue. So she just presented those to the president, showing here are a number of the different things, and she communicated to him the Twining memo, where General Twining, who was the head of the United States Air Force, you know, said that these are not ours, and that was in a classified report that these were not ours, and that we had officially concluded that they did not come from the Soviet Union or any other country on our planet. And so, you know, she just submitted that information to the president so that he would see that the highest levels United States Air Force officials had concluded that these were almost certainly from some other extraterrestrial civilization. And those documents now have been set forth by Richard Dolan in his very, very widely respected two-volume study of UFOs and the national security state. You know, those Twining memos are all available for people now.
But Carter didn't, so he said, okay, he looked at the stuff, but that was the end of it? I mean, as far as I know,
that obviously we would have known if he had issued any public statements or anything about this, but he had demanded this information from George H.W. Bush. George Bush Sr. was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency under President Ford from 1975 to 1977. So after President Carter was elected in November of 1976, in December of 1976, even before he took office in January of 77, Carter met as the president-elect, met with George Bush and asked George Bush to show him the information that the CIA had about UFOs, and George Bush refused to give it to him. he demanded to say, look, if you want me to give this information to you, you have to agree to keep me on as your CIA director. And Jimmy Carter didn't agree to do that, and so George Bush refused to give it to him. And so that's why President Carter, you know, undertook this other process of trying to get the Congressional Research Service to file formal applications to declassify some of this stuff to give it to him.
But anyway, he seemed like, because of the evidence that came to him, and of course the Project Blue Book, was he silenced, do you think, by people Because, you know, it seems like that's happened.
I don't know. I don't know because I never spoke with him about it. I don't know why it is that the presidents don't reveal the information. I know that Bill Clinton had talked about it, as we know, and tried to get the information, and it was concealed from him. And we also know that President Kennedy attempted to get the information from the FBI and the CIA.
But was it really concealed from him, or is that just what he's saying? Because there's, of course, that Lawrence Rockefeller meeting with Bill and Hillary, and, of course, Lawrence Rockefeller was very much informed about the whole matter.
Yeah, no, very much. One of the major challenges that we have as American citizens, and it's not that people from other countries don't have the same challenge with their government, but the problem is that they lie. They lie to the American people, you know, because they think that they're somehow privileged to lie based upon what they consider to be national security. And I have no doubt at all, based upon, you know, 45 years of investigating the national security apparatus in the United States, I have no question whatsoever but that during the entire duration of the Cold War, that if they had come across direct proof, which I'm sure they did at Roswell, that the extraterrestrial intelligence was real and that they actually were coming here to our planet, that they never would have told anybody in the public. They would have simply, you know, tried to analyze the technology to decide if they could make weapons with it.
Well, which, you know, is what they probably have done, But let me ask you, because you're really the person to talk to, because you've worked in the political system, you worked in the legal system, you understand corporate conspiracy. Let's talk about that with the Karen Silkwood. I mean, you understand the total perspective, and you also understand worldviews and the paradigm shift and what because you've worked with the New Paradigm Project with Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yes.
And so you understand the whole scope of the issue that everyone, and let's call it the disclosure movement, is trying to work towards. What will it take for this to break free of the corporate military complex, or whatever you want to call it, that keeps the lid on it? What do you feel?
Well, my own personal opinion is, and I'm going to be talking about this at the Joshua Tree event, is that I believe that the process that is going to be utilized by the national security state is they're going to be coming in through the window of all of the new planets that are being discovered by the Hubble telescope and the new Planck telescope and others. They're going to be saying, it's only been in the last 15 years that the scientific community is actually officially acknowledging that other planets even exist other than those in our solar system. And so now that they've seen them and they can they've developed specialized lenses for the telescopes now, the space-based telescopes, to be able to actually see these planets. They filter out the bright sunlight. So they're starting to, and now they've discovered over 2,300 planets. And of these, they're figuring that almost 20% of the star systems in our Milky Way galaxy, with 500 billion star systems, have planets. About 20% of them, and there's a smaller percentage of them that are planets located in what they call the Goldilocks zone, where they're not too far away from the sun or not too close to the sun to be able to get adequate solar light and energy from the sun, and potentially have liquid water, et cetera. So we're going to go through a process here during our lifetimes. I'm quite confident during our lifetimes, where the national security state and scientific community are going to basically feather in to the public, first saying, "Oh, we found planets where we think that life is likely." Then they're going to say, "Oh, we found planets where we're almost certain that life is going to exist." then they're going to discover that they have found evidence of life in its simple form, amoebas and single-cell life. And then they're going to say later, oh, look, we found a more complex life like plankton and small sea life. Then they're going to take a position that they found live, you know, amphibian life. And they're going to go through this protracted process until they eventually come to a position where they're going to assert that they have found evidence of an intelligent civilization. And they're
right,
going to maintain that it's just too far away, that we can't get there. We can't realistically communicate with them because they're too many light years away. And, you know, but they're going to eventually acknowledge that there is another civilization that may well have discovered a technology that's capable of coming here. But they're acclimating an entire two generations, the baby boomer generation and the millennial generation. They're acclimating us to accepting this because they've convinced themselves, I believe, that for all the national security reasons why they felt that they wanted to conceal this and try to develop weaponry using the technology, they've convinced themselves that pursuant to things like the old Brookings Institution report they had prepared, is that to tell us blank, flat out that other civilizations exist is going to traumatize us in some way. They've actually sort of convinced themselves as a rationale for their having concealed this from us for so long. And so therefore, this benign process of slowly feathering this information out to us is the best way to proceed. And I assume how it's going to happen. And
but
it'll happen
seems
within
a little
our lifetime.
Silly.
Pardon?
No, I was just saying it seems so silly that they're saying, well, there's life on these exoplanets, but, you know, we're being visited all the time. UFOs
are common.
Yeah, I know.
It's absurd, yeah. But on the other hand, it's absurd for, you know, the massive global climate change that's taking place that everybody can see taking place, and the entire majority party that controls the Congress says they don't believe it. You know, I mean, there's lots of absurd things that go on, and they're usually because there's some kind of powerful oligarchical interest in keeping the information from the people, and most of our people are trained through their public school systems to believe generally what the people in positions of authority tell them. And so that's what's happening right now, except the reality is that over 60% of the people in our two generations, you know, the baby boomer generation of 82 million citizens and the millennial generation of 76 million, the vast majority of us, over 60% of us, believe that there certainly is extraterrestrial intelligence, and we believe that at least some of the sightings are virtually certainly vehicles from this one or more civilizations. So, you know, you might say that the process of trying to conceal it from us is not working, but in fact, the process of slowly feathering the information into us and changing the consciousness of the majority is in fact working. So that's exactly what's happening.
No, I think that is in fact working. And, you know, last year we had 2,000 people at the contact in the desert, and partly people come together just to talk to each other about what they've experienced and witnessed. And I think what needs to happen is sort of the direction you're working is this a different way of thinking about who we are and our place in the universe. And
that's right.
So let's talk about that. And John Mack, of course, was a big part of saying these people aren't crazy. They've had experiences. Something real is going on, but we have to think differently in terms of consciousness. So how would you outline this new worldview that needs to come into place?
Well, I think that you remember that Father Fuentes, who is the head of the Vatican Observatory at Castel Gandolfo in Rome, you know, back in 2009, in October of 2009, they convened a major conference of world scientists and stuff, and they came forward and held a press conference at the Vatican and actually said, Father Fuentes said that it's his belief that not only is it fairly clear that an extraterrestrial civilization exists, but that it's very likely that in the comparatively near future that we're going to establish contact with them. And he said that therefore it's incumbent upon us all to start a process of the scientists and lay people, people in the churches and synagogues and mosques, and stuff, to start having an intelligent conversation about what we believe the theological and philosophical implications are of discovering that we are not only no longer physically located in the center of the universe like we thought we were up until Copernicus right. and Galileo, but that in fact we're not even any longer at the apex of all biological evolution.
That there, yeah, I think that has huge
that there
ramifications.
Are civilizations that are millions of years advanced to us.
Right. And that has, just like Galileo and Copernicus, those have used byproduct implications on the civilization itself. So where does it take us, you think?
Well, I think that one of the very first impacts of this is going to be to, I hope, that there are going to be two phenomena that are going to be occurring. That I'm sad about one of them happening, and I hope it wouldn't, but there's going to be an entire element of our human family, the people who are adherents to the second paradigm dialectical worldview, are going to view this as terribly frightening news, that somehow there is another civilization that is advanced beyond us technologically, and that they're going to feel threatened. They're going to think that this other civilization could, and you know, you can see that that's been taken advantage of, that particular instinctive worldview, by, you know, almost all of the major, almost all the major motion pictures, that they've yeah. got the extraterrestrial beings all constitute some kind of a terrible threat to us. But that there's another whole dimension, another worldview, which is the sixth paradigm, kind of radical monist progressive worldview, that is going to perceive this as an extraordinarily good piece of news, in the sense that they can see that there is a biological evolutionary process pursuant to which species such as ours, if we don't destroy ourselves with thermonuclear weapons or some other huge weapon of mass destruction that we, you know, probe into the center of matter and pull out weaponry out of it, you know, if we don't kill ourselves, you know, that there's the good news, the same good news that, for example, Jesus and the prophets talked about, mm-hmm. of saying, look, you know, look at me, that I am the good news, that there is an evolutionary process underway pursuant to which our human family is evolving a faculty by means of which we can directly and immediately experientially encounter the unitive phenomenon that bonds the entire physical universe together into a harmonious whole. It's a faculty much like sight is to light and hearing is to sound waves, that we can experience this directly, and that this communicates to us immediately and experientially the unity of all being. And therefore, we can go on, as Crane Brinton said, the founder and the chairman of the Department of Intellectual History at Harvard University. He said on December 20th of 1967, in his final lecture on intellectual history at Harvard, he said that he believes that our species is on the very brink of evolving fully this faculty, and that it, in fact, is going to enable every single individual human being to experientially discern what type of conduct, you know, either individual or collective, is either harmonious with or disharmonious to the entire natural order of the universe.
Now, what was his name again? What was this guy? Because I'd like to find that quote.
Yeah, Crane Brinton. His name is Professor Crane Brinton. He was the chairman of the Department of Intellectual History at Harvard University. He retired on December 20th of 1967, and this is the final lecture that he delivered at Lowell Hall. Now, I don't I mean, I was there, so I know that he did it, and there were hundreds and hundreds of other Harvard graduates that had been there. And I don't know that anybody has publicized it much. I mean, I've talked about it a bunch because I was so thunderstruck by his saying it that he concluded that the best minds of the human family were all clear about this, that the most important intellectual insight that he had encountered in his entire 50 years of intellectual history studies was that the best minds of our human family were aware of the everything that's being talked about by scientists and poets and everything else, this mystical faculty that the human being has, this extrasensory perception, this whole set of faculties that we have are biologically evolving. And that, that this gives us access, and so that all of the spiritual talk, you know, about mystics and prophets and people with the powers of precognition and all of these type of faculties, these are all functions of a new faculty that our human family is evolving, and it's mysterious to us in a sense, since we're caught inside of it. And very few people have gotten outside of it to kind of look at it objectively, like we have now been able to look at sight or hearing or taste or touch. You know, these are direct experiential senses that we have evolved, and we have this category that we have for them of, oh, that's a biological sense. And all that means is you can directly experience a certain type of vibrational frequency or stimuli of sound or light. And in this particular case, it's just a much, much, much higher frequency, a more subtle dimension. That we all know that every single integer of matter in the entire physical universe is directly bonded and attached to every other one, and that the degree of attachment or attraction is just inversely proportional to the square of the distance between the two items. That's all that it is. But it's a field. It's an actual vibrational frequency, and that it's just like light or sound. It's a particular electromagnetic frequency that functions through gravity, and that we can experience it. Only they just haven't acknowledged it yet. They haven't acknowledged that this is actually going on. So there's this entire mythos that's evolved around spirituality and the different types of prophets and people like Jesus, you know, who was so aware of the direct relationship between mass and energy that he could actually transmute matter, you know, by direct human intentionality. All of that now has been shown by Max Planck and during the experiments that went on between 1923 and 1926. You know, where they demonstrated the whole underlying premises of quantum reality now. And this is extraordinarily exciting, and it's what we're encountering with some of these extraterrestrial beings. We can't quite understand how it is that they can communicate telepathically. We can't understand how they can actually pass through walls, how they can accelerate beyond the speed of light. We're not understanding it yet, but it's all a function of this quantum realm that we're just starting to open onto now. And so these are some of the things I'm going to be discussing.
Yeah, there's a science.
Pardon?
No, I say there's obviously a science to mysticism, to evolving spirituality. But I am interested, if you don't mind, going through the levels of worldviews that I've heard you outline many places, and how that might relate to spiral dynamics or Ken Wilber stuff. But what's your take? What are the levels?
There's an octave. It's not surprising. In the same way, there's an entire octave of color vibrations, you know, from the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, you know, indigo and violet, you know, our senses, our other senses, in hearing, you know, the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. I mean, you know, there's an octave of access that we have in our present human incarnation to a certain octave set of vibrational frequencies that we see as an integrated reality. And the same thing is true of our access to worldviews, is that they're the first paradigm worldview. All of these worldviews are made up. There's four fundamental philosophical questions that exist, posed to our human family. And one of them is the cosmological question, is how did the entire cosmos come into existence? You know, that old question, why is there something rather than nothing? Why does the physical universe actually exist, and how did it come into being? It's the fundamental cosmological question that faces human beings. The second question is a teleological question, they refer to it as, is that this physical universe is unfolding in a particular way. Lots of time and energy is spent trying to analyze it. It appears that that all of the matter, the mass and energy in the universe, is expanding out in the way from the locus of the original Big Bang. And at the same time, every single unit of mass in whatever the element is on the entire periodic tables, that, you know, all 238 of them, whatever it is that every single one of them is disintegrating into its lower constituent elements. And each element has its own particular rate of atomic breakdown, the length of time it takes the mass of that particular element to disintegrate into its constituent elements. But so that what we see the teleological question is that it seems to be that our universe is expanding out and away from the locus of the Big Bang and at the same time disintegrating into its smaller constituent parts. So the question that really gets posed, the teleological question, is, you know, is this going to continue to expand and disintegrate forever? And if it does, you know, that when ultimately every last integer of mass in the universe has disintegrated into its constituent inchoate quantum fields. I mean, when we break down a proton, you know, that at one time they didn't think you could break down an atom, but we discovered you can by colliding them together. Then you can break them into their protons and neutrons and electrons. And then what they discovered is you can take one of the protons and you fire two of them at each other in a particle accelerator, and when they hit each other, they break into smaller constituent parts. And so you start to get muons, you know, and you get leptons, and they have names they've given for them, but what it is if you continue to break them down one after another, you eventually get down to the point where when you collide two of them together, they disappear. And all that exists is an inchoate quantum field. By inchoate, that means it's non-manifest. It doesn't manifest as either energy or mass. It's non-material. It just exists in a state of potential. And what they realize, they've observed these, after they've collided two of the smallest particles together and they disappear, and all there is this inchoate quantum field, what they discover is that inchoate quantum field will re-emerge, re-manifest as a form of matter, either a particle of mass or a wavelength of energy. But it does so in a completely random manner, and that there's no way to predict whether a particular inchoate quantum field will manifest in the next microsecond as a particle of mass or a wave of energy. But what they discovered back between 1923 and 1926 is that if in fact an individual human being directs our human intention toward an inchoate quantum field, willing that inchoate quantum field to manifest in its next material incarnation as either a particle of mass or a wave of energy, it will do so to a statistically significant degree. Now, that was just an absolutely astonishing discovery, because it basically undermines the entire fundamental premise of Newtonian Cartesian physics, that in fact somehow the physical universe functions completely independent of human intention. And so that's one of the major discoveries that was made at that point. And the other is that if you take two of these, the smallest particles that you can get, like a muon or a lepton, and you accelerate them in a particle accelerator away from each other, at the speed of light, moving in completely opposite directions at the speed of light, if in fact you would apply pressure to one of them, even if they're you know, 2 billion miles away from each other, if you apply a force to one of them and move it out of its path, moving away from the other one that was part of the pair will, in fact, move too. And so that they realize that there is a field, a unified field that is functioning in which in which every single ultimately irreducible integer of matter in the universe is directly bonded to every other one. And that
the entangled field.
That's right. And the effect is manifest faster than the speed of light. So right. there is a phenomenon that functions that way. So all of these things.
We have to integrate that. Yes.
So that second philosophical question, the teleological question, that functions about how the universe is unfolding, and whether or not it's going to ultimately disintegrate. Or whether at the point where every single inchoate quantum field is separate and apart from every other one, does that moment occur, that microsecond occur, at the point at which the impetus that's been imposed upon all of them, causing them all to expand out and away from the locus of the Big Bang, does the impetus that's been imposed upon them at that point expire? And therefore, they stand in a state of stasis for a microsecond, all bonded to each other, and the impetus that is moving them apart from each other from the Big Bang is exhausted, and still the bonding phenomenon still obtains, and so that after a microsecond of standing in a state of stasis, they all begin to collapse back in upon each other. And then they recombine, and they recombine to form muons, then leptons, and then electrons, and then protons and neutrons, and atoms of elements, and then compounds and mixtures and planets and star systems. But they're all, in fact, collapsing back in on each other as distinct from expanding out the way.
Every moment that's actually happening, that process.
That's exactly right. And the theory is that this occurs. Adherence to the first paradigm worldview, the entropical worldview, believe that in fact that the expansion is going to continue forever. In fact, they're going to reach a point where every ultimately irreducible integer of matter is separate and apart from each other, and it will continue to expand into no thingness. Nothingness. It'll just disintegrate and go away. And that is the teleological assumption of the adherence to the first paradigm worldview. And so that is the second of the fundamental questions. And there are four of these fundamental questions, the cosmological question that I posed initially of how the universe comes into being, the adherents of the first paradigm worldview believe that it just came into being from the Big Bang. It just blew into existence, and it's ultimately going to blow out of existence, and that we only exist in the interim. And so that's the cosmological answer that they provided to the cosmological question. The teleological answer is that it's going to disintegrate. The third essential question, in addition to the cosmological question and the teleological question, is the ontological question, as they refer to it in philosophy. And all that really means is just a fancy word for how did consciousness come into existence? Assuming that the cosmos, the physical cosmos, has come into existence or has always existed, depending on which position you take, and is expanding and or expanding and contracting and expanding and contracting, that's the second paradigm assumption about the teleological question. Now, the third question, this ontological question, is how did consciousness come into being? Is consciousness nothing more than the interaction between mass and energy, that is some kind of epiphenomenon, like sort of an echo of some sort of the interface in action between mass and energy? And that it's just an epiphenomenon, or in fact, did consciousness pre-exist the universe? Did consciousness actually will into being and fold into being the original unit of mass that then exploded into the Big Bang? This ontological question is one of the most fundamental questions, of the nature of being, the nature of consciousness, you know? And the fourth and final of the four fundamental questions is the epistemological question. This is the question that asks, you know, what are the various means that we as human beings have access to by means of which we can possibly answer questions like that? Are we limited to the experience of our five senses, you know, process the data garnered from those experiences of our five senses only, processing it through our intellect, and therefore we're bonded by only the data that we can physically discern through our five senses, and whether there's other phenomena going on or not, it's irrelevant because we can't discern it at all. And so that we're limited epistemologically to just the experience of our five senses. And we can process it through our intellect, but that's the limitation of what we can do. But there are other epistemological assumptions for different worldviews. But the first paradigm worldview is the one that assumes that epistemologically that the only what we can see or touch or smell or of our five senses, that's all there is. They actually collapse reality into saying all that is only what we can see and touch and taste and feel, you know, and that there's no sense to it. It just is chaotic. Things occur at random, and therefore, since chaos reigns, the only way to impose any type of order upon chaos is through the assertion of will, and that the will of a dominant, powerful individual is the only means of imparting order to the universe. And so what you get is an authoritarian worldview, that there's a powerful king or baron or magnate of some sort who superimposes his will upon all the people that dwell within a particular region. And you get warrior kings, you get authoritarian types like Genghis Khan or others, but this is the authoritarian worldview, the first paradigm worldview, that's because they have answered the four pillar questions, the cosmological, the teleological, the ontological, and the epistemological questions. They've answered those four questions in a completely internally and self-referentially consistent manner. So that it's generated a very particular mode of ethical reasoning predicated upon those answers. And then when you apply that mode of ethical reasoning to the normal questions of life, you end up with a philosophy, a fully consistent philosophy. And then derivative of your philosophy is your political philosophy, and that is, you know, how should, based upon the application of that mode of ethical reasoning, you know, how should a community best organize ourselves to make collective decisions that we have to make? Is it, in fact, the authoritarian worldview of having some super strong and willful individual person, ideally, hopefully intelligent, make a decision and impose it upon everyone else? You know, or is the mode of ethical reasoning of that, which is primarily self-interest, the maximization of self-interest, the maximization of pleasure, the minimalization of pain? It's what Thomas Hobbes talks about all the time. You know, that these are that first worldview is though that is the set of cosmological, teleological, ontological, and epistemological beliefs that generate that if you answer all of them consistently, it generates the mode of ethical reasoning of self-interest.
And that's where we still, unfortunately, we haven't evolved collectively that far beyond that first level, have we?
Well, actually, there are some beings who have. There are others who have evolved farther, that they have, for example, they have come to the conclusion that in fact, the universe is not made up of chaos. They've been able, in the second paradigm worldview, for example, they've been able to discern what they view to be a dialectic. They, in fact, believe that when the expansion of the universe teleologically reaches the point where every ultimately irreducible integer of matter has disintegrated into its constituent inchoate quantum fields, that, in fact, the impetus imposed upon them by the Big Bang does, in fact, expire. And in fact, the attractor force does then set in and start to draw them all back together. And so they do, in fact, begin to reintegrate and form muons and leptons and electrons, and they reconstitute the physical universe, and they actually regenerate the universe. It's just that it's all collapsing back in upon each other until ultimately every ultimately irreducible integer of matter in the universe or inchoate quantum fields are in direct physical contact with every other one. And the entire universe then is condensed into the size of a head of a pin. You hear that. You hear astrophysicists talk about that all the time, but nobody understands what it means. And but at that particular point, the polarity reverses itself immediately and generates another Big Bang. Not an explosion from the center out, but every single ultimately irreducible integer of matter repelling every other one. And that's what the cosmic Big Bang is about. And now that's the cosmological assumption of the second paradigm, the adherence to the second paradigm, is that therefore the universe has always existed. It just oscillates between a state of absolute mass and absolute energy. And during the interim, there are these manifestations of various confluences of mass and energy that constitute the planets and the galaxies and life forms, etc., and that has a fundamentally different cosmological and teleological set of assumptions. And ontologically, it actually believes that that consciousness, while perhaps just an epiphenomenon of the interaction between mass and energy, is a lot more than just something that's completely random and ephemeral, and that it's just going to disappear out of existence, because it always exists. It in fact always exists, and in fact it's another element of existence, just like mass and energy is. But consciousness is another phenomenon in addition to mass and energy. And so that they have a different ontological assumption. And epistemologically, they believe that through the exercise of consciousness, that consciousness is a faculty. So that, you know, that you can through the experience of your consciousness, you can actually access information. That you can consciously become aware of the bonding phenomenon in the universe, and you can discern through subtle experiences of consciousness, the actual physical, physiological makeup of the universe. And that's how you can tell about things that are going to be in the future or things that have been in the past, because all of the universe is one entity, even though it's expanding and contracting, that if you can discern subtly enough, you can discern vastly back into the past and up into the future, because time itself doesn't exist. Time is all completely eternal. The oscillation of the cosmos from they call this the magnum annus, the grand year, the oscillation or the periodos, they call it, the great oscillation from one state of ultimate condensation into ultimate expansion and then back into the ultimate condensation. That is the magnum annus. That's the major year. Now that's a second paradigm worldview. And it's categorically distinct in every way from the beliefs of the first paradigm worldview, okay? And so this continues on through all eight worldviews. There's an entire octave of worldviews that at least our human species in our present form of incarnation and our present state of biological evolution is able to discern. Seven of these worldviews, and we have not yet. And the worldviews run from, you know, you can identify them by their political philosophy or their philosophy or their cosmology. You can identify these eight different worldviews by any one of these places where you insert yourself into the analysis.
Is there a place where these are outlined? Do you have a website for the worldview outline?
Actually, I do. There's a whole monograph. There's a whole 700-page monograph that talks about this and relates it to Republicans and Democrats and progressives and reactionaries. You know, because if you cut into this at the level of political philosophy, which is a derivative of the philosophy of each of these worldviews, and the philosophy is derivative of the application of the mode of ethical reasoning, to the fundamental questions of life. These are all derivative of one another. And there's 10 basic aspects to every worldview. It's its cosmology, teleology, ontology, epistemology, mode of ethical reasoning, philosophy, political philosophy, then the theory of human psychology, the mode of spiritual expression, and the social form. What social form is generated? What forms of community, human community, are generated, predicated upon the assumptions of this worldview? And so I've got this. I'm in the process. I'm teaching a whole course at the University of California at Santa Cruz in constitutional law, and about natural law theory, which is all a portion of the sixth paradigm worldview, the radical monist worldview that's talked about by the Stoics, the ancient Greek Stoics.
Is it outlined somewhere on a website?
I'm going to end up putting it all up there, because as it turns out, the students keep on asking to see what I've written out about it. So I've got this big huge 700-page monogram or monograph. It's called it's called Paradigm Politics. The making of the new world order at the end of the Cold War.
No, I think it's fascinating, because the big challenge, of course, comes when worldviews collide, and I think there's no better example of that as when you were legal counsel to John Mack at Harvard. And here's
that's right.
And so talk about the collision of worldviews that you witnessed firsthand, and how you were able to, in a way, sway, from what I've heard, the really conservative, uptight Harvard mentality into something. Well, yeah, talk about that, because I think
it was interesting. It was very interesting how that all came about. That John, as you know, John had been asked he was the chairman of the Department of Clinical Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And a very conservative guy, and came from a fairly wealthy family, a kind of aristocratic Brahmin family in Massachusetts.
Right.
Bud Hopkins had approached him and asked him to do a psychological evaluation of a few different people who had these direct UFO encounters. Encounters of the third kind, where they actually encounter beings from another civilization, another star system, and so John did a number of interviews of these people, and then started having people who were military officers and stuff sent to talk to him, and he went ahead and did a full kind of psychological workup on these folks, and said, "This is astonishing, because these people all fall within the normal range of human psychology. These people are perfectly normal, except for the fact that they've had this experience."
He finally
said, "Look, this is an extraordinarily bizarre phenomenon." And he started doing these. He doesn't hypnotize people. He would use Stan Grof's, Stanislav Grof's holotropic breathing, to get them just to relax and get into a totally relaxed state, but not hypnotize them, so they weren't subject to any kind of post-hypnotic suggestion or anything. And he would just get them to calm down and relax and remember verbatim what it is that happened to them. And he finally was so fascinated by the stories, he started asking them when he got really slowed down and started to relive this experience they were having. He would ask them these minute questions about, like, okay, if you're inside the vehicle, look around and tell me what you see. And they would describe different kind of instruments and technical things that were inside the craft. And he became astonished, because people who had never had any contact with each other whatsoever and had never read anything about these things were describing in detail very similar types of technology that they saw inside these crafts.
And he was still a professor at Harvard, of course. And published
he was the chairman of the Department of Clinical Psychiatry at Harvard. And he decided he was going to write an article for the New England Journal of Medicine. And he was already a Pulitzer Prize winner. He won the Pulitzer Prize for writing the definitive psychobiography of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. And he wrote this article, a scientific article, and sent it to the New England Journal of Medicine. And after a very short period of time, they sent it right back to him and said they weren't going to publish it. So he was kind of taken aback, and so he said he wrote a letter to them and said, what is it you want me to do? You want more footnotes? Do you want more of this or that? What is it you want me to do? And they didn't answer him. So he redid the whole article and thoroughly briefed everything and footnoted it and went through this entire scientific pedagogy and put it all together, and then he sent it back to him. And the assistant editor of the New England Journal of Medicine showed up in his office with the envelope that John had sent to them, mm-hmm. and saying, look, I've been told by Dr. Relman, who's the executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, to return this to you and make it clear that it's not been opened. We didn't open it, we haven't read it, and we're not going to publish it. And so he was really upset about this, and so he called publishers and said, look, my name is Dr. John Mack. I'm the chairman of the Department of Harvard Clinical Psychiatry, and I want to write this book. And so he right away got one of the publishers that wanted to publish his book, so he sat down and wrote the whole thing up as a book and published it. And yeah, that was, Abductions, Human Encounters with Aliens.
And then he started to do television shows and get a lot of press.
Well, no, not at first. What happened is that he published it, and right within a matter of a week of it having been published, before it really got to be big and famous, he was contacted by the president or the dean of the medical school. And the guy came to his office and said, John, I understand that you've written this book called Abductions, Human Contacts with Aliens. I'd be really interested in having you explain more about this to me. Would you be willing to meet with myself and a number of other people from the faculty to discuss this? And well, John was ecstatic. He said, this is fabulous. Great. Let's do it. So he thought he was going to have like this grand rounds about this particular phenomenon that he found to be so fascinating. And when he showed up, here was the president of, here was the dean of the medical school, and sitting right next to him was the legal counsel for Harvard University, and four other people from the faculty sitting up there as this tribunal. And it turns out that the tribunal was being chaired by the same guy who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And Relman, John Relman, there he was, And so John was kind of taken aback by this whole thing, and Relman started reaming him out, started hollering at him and accusing him of unethical conduct and complete irresponsibility and blah, blah, blah. And so John was kind of freaked out by what happened. So what he did is he left the meeting and went and called his mother, actually. called his mother and said, look, this awful thing just happened to me. So she referred him to their family attorney, and he went to see the family attorney, and I think it was at Ropes and Gray, or one of the big firms in Boston. It was one of them. And he went over there, and he sat down and explained what was going on, and said that Relman and the other guys were demanding the tape recordings of his interviews and whether he charged them for the interviews, and did they get insurance to pay him for doing these interviews? Was he treating it medically or clinically? Did he tell them that he was going to write a book? All these kind of things. And so the lawyer just said to him, "Oh, tell them everything. Give them whatever they want. Just give them the tape recordings. Don't pay any attention to confidentiality with your patient or anything. Just give it to him." And he didn't think that that was logical advice. And then he discovered that that was the same law firm that represents Harvard University.
Oh.
And so he ends up telling his best friend Roberts about this, and Professor Roberts was John's best friend, been his best man at his wedding. They were in the United States Air Force together back in Japan and after the war and stuff. So Professor Roberts ended up calling me and asked me if I would come to dinner at his house. So I went to dinner at his house, and it was kind of almost deja vu all over again. as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, of when I had dinner with the executive secretary of the National Academy of Science, and with Rosie Chalk, and we're sitting there at the end of the dinner, and we're having dessert. And Professor Roberts said to me, he said he was a professor at Santa Barbara City College, and he said Dan, he said, I'm kind of curious. Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? I said, no, it's fine. What? He said, what do you think of this issue of extraterrestrial intelligence? Mm-hmm. And I said, I think it's one of the most important subjects that there is imaginable. I said,
exactly.
I think it's astonishingly important. He said, well, that's amazing. He said, how come you never said anything about it? And I said, well, nobody asked me. And mm-hmm. so he said, look, let me tell you something. He said, my best friend is Dr. John Mack, the head of the Department of Clinical Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. This big thing is happening. He explained what happened to me. He said, would you be willing to take a call from John? And so I did, and John called me, and Dr. Mack asked me to come to Cambridge and meet with him, and I did, and he asked me to represent him in front of this this tribunal. And so he and I went and met with a number of different sources, and then we actually went and met with Lawrence Rockefeller, and spent the whole afternoon with Lawrence Rockefeller down in New York. And Lawrence Rockefeller agreed to finance, you know, the calling of as many witnesses as we wanted, and the presentation of whatever evidence we wanted to present to the Harvard faculty.
Let me just ask you a side note about Lawrence Rockefeller. Was he totally convinced about the presence of UFOs and very much supportive?
Oh, yes.
Totally.
Oh, no, he was very clear about that. It was because his best friend was the Prince of Liechtenstein. And that they'd known each other since they were boys, because I guess they were both richer than the Pope.
Right.
And they knew each other. And his best friend, the Prince of Liechtenstein, had seen a UFO, full scale, walked right up to it, apparently, and put his hand on it. And so he was completely convinced that it was true. And so he agreed to finance whatever we wanted to do. So John was delighted. John said, oh, good, we're going to have a grand rounds at Harvard University with the faculty. We're going to get to call, you know, Air Force colonels and generals and, you know, the head of the investigation of the FAA and everybody that we knew. And so we went back to the committee, and he and I walked in together, and we sat down. And, you know, and Dr. Rawls, the chairman just began kind of interrogating him. And so I stood up, I said, excuse me. I said, look, my name's Dan Sheehan, you know, I'm a graduate of Harvard College, Harvard Law School, you know, did my master's work on comparative social ethics at Harvard Divinity School, and started my PhD work before I went to Jesuit headquarters. I said, I'm here representing Dr. Mack. Can you tell me exactly what it is we're doing here? I mean, what is this? You know, this isn't some kind of friendly gathering, you know, that the dean of the dean of the medical school just wants to have kind of a casual, friendly conversation with John. This is some kind of tribunal here. I said, this isn't an AAUP, you know, Association of University Professors, a gathering of any kind. That, you know, that this is just some kind of rump group that's been put together here. And there was this big silence, and Dr. Rawls said, well, he said, what happened is that when Dr. Mack wrote this book, Abductions, you know, Human Contact with Aliens, he said, all of a sudden the dean of the medical school started getting all kinds of phone calls, you know, asking him questions about this, and he found that he wasn't in a position to really be able to answer any of those questions. So he wanted to talk to John. And so he figured, as long as he was going to be talking to John, why didn't he just have some other faculty people come? I mean, it was just this complete lying ration of bullshit, you know, he gives it.
So
I said, okay, if that's the case, you know, can you tell me, who is it that called?
Mm-hmm.
And it was this great big deadly silence for like about 30 seconds. And they all looked at each other, and finally the general counsel for Harvard University, you know, wagged her head back and forth, telling him no, he wasn't going to answer it. And Roman said, oh, I'm sorry, we're not at liberty to discuss that. And I said, really? Mm-hmm. I said, well, okay, then if he was being asked questions that he didn't quite know the answer to, can you tell me, at least if you want us to shed light on some of those questions, what were the questions that he was being asked? And it was another big long silence. And the legal counsel for Harvard, you know, shook her head no, not to answer. And she said, no, I'm sorry, we're not at liberty to discuss that either. And so I said to him, okay, well, look, let's get something clear. I said, can you tell me at least this? He said, during the course of this proceeding, whatever it is here, do you believe that either one of the following two questions is going to be at issue? Number one, whether or not another highly technologically developed, intelligent but non-human civilization exists in the universe somewhere. And secondly, whether or not at least some of these UFO sightings that have occurred could actually be vehicles from an extraterrestrial civilization. You know, I put the question right to them, the same two questions that Marcia Smith was charged with by the president for finding out the answers to. And I happen to have copies of both of the classified reports, so I knew what the answers were. And Relman said to me, he said, well, absolutely those two questions are going to be at issue. And you know, and it's completely ridiculous for anyone to believe that either one of those things is true. That's what he said. Here he is, the editor.
You set him up for that, didn't you?
You know, and so I said, well, good. I said, good. Then I think it's really fair to tell you all that, you know, that John and I have spent an entire afternoon with Lawrence Rockefeller. He's agreed to finance the presentation of any evidence that we want on this, and we're going to be happy to do this. We're going to bring witnesses. We're going to videotape the whole thing. We can have a big grand round. You can ask any questions you want, and we're happy to do this. And the legal counsel for Harvard University leaped to her feet and said, absolutely not. We're not going to transform this hearing into some kind of circus, she said.
Wow.
And I said, well, I said, thank you very much. I said, but, you know, when you get ready to actually listen to the evidence and ask the questions you want to answer, you know, you just call us and let us know. And so I just reached out and grabbed John and lifted him up out of his chair, and we walked out on him. And so
they wanted to fire John, right,
for
writing that book? Is that part of, like, the whole thing? Go ahead. So what then happened?
Well, no. So what happened is, you know, all these guys spent, you know, a matter of several hours with their hair on fire, I'm sure, trying to figure out what to do about all this. And they finally, you know, and I went and got a hold of, what was his name, is Eric McLeish. A young lawyer there in Boston, to recruit him to be local counsel, because I was admitted in New York City and you know, Manhattan in Washington D.C., but I wasn't admitted there in Boston. So I got Eric McLeish to be local counsel, and we were prepared to go forward. And then they finally, the committee wrote a letter. The dean of the medical school wrote a letter to John, apologizing profusely for any misunderstanding, saying that it must have been misconstrued. It was just supposed to be a friendly conversation. It was a total load of crap, and they backed out and they apologized to him. So John went ahead and formed this thing called the Project for Extraordinary Experience Research, the peer group at Harvard. And had circles of people come who had these direct contact experiences. You know, all the people weren't credible. You know, some yahoos were there, but we kind of, you know, thinned those people out right away. I've gotten to meet dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have had this experience, who are completely credible.
You're going to meet a bunch more at Contact, for sure.
Yeah, right. You know, well, we'll meet both varieties, I'm sure. I mean, some of the old tinfoil hat people will be there with the antennas on their head, and others, I imagine. But the bottom line is there are hundreds of people that are absolutely, totally credible, don't have any logical reason for telling a story like this. I mean, it's completely dysfunctional to them. You know, it gets them only in trouble and causes all their friends and neighbors and family to you know, shun them, you know. So there's no rational reason for many of these people, you know, police officers, you know, lawyers, judges, you know.
Oh, of course, there's been thousands of thousands. But getting back to John Mack for a second, so you never did have a trial with Harvard. There was never
No. It's another one of those things where I kick myself over. You know, I should have just shut up and let him do it, and then just waded right on into him and started presenting the witnesses. You know, but I basically leveled with them and told them exactly what I was going to do, And so they just completely collapsed in the face of it and chickened right out. You know, so I should have just led them in to it. But I don't like deceiving people at all. You know, I've spent 45 years as a practicing trial attorney. So, you know, at the beginning of a trial, I tell them right flat out, look, here's the story here. Here's the truth of the matter, and I'm going to explain it all to you. And you know, there's always one person in the courtroom that the jury believes and knows that they're telling them the truth because they've always leveled with them, and that's what I've always done throughout 45 years of trial practice. You know, and that's why we've won virtually every case we've ever done. It's just kind of a unique way of doing law. You know, you're not just a hired gun to make up stuff. You know.
So the whole Harvard John Mack incident really only came down to like these two encounters then with Harvard.
In the exchange of the letters where they were apologizing, you know, that they had written out a whole bunch of demands of them, and then they finally apologized and withdrew all the demands.
They made of John? Do you remember?
Well, they were demanding that he turn over all of the tape recordings of any of the sessions, of whether or not he billed them. Did any of them seek insurance, health insurance, to pay for them? You know, what were the kind of did he give any leading questions to them? You know, et cetera. You know, had he ever talked to any of the direct other witnesses that he made reference to in the book? You know, it was just a bunch of hooey, really.
Well, did they ever threaten to fire him, or did
they didn't have any authority to do that. They, you know, that if they were going to do something like that, they would have had to convene a panel that was subject to the American Association of University Professors. I mean, there's a whole kind of set of urban legends that surround this particular encounter because it has a certain kind of lore in the entire UFO community.
Well, because it actually characterizes that those opposing worldviews meeting head on.
Doubt about it. And that's why John wrote a big manuscript about the whole thing. It's called When Worldviews Collide. I've got the only copy of it.
Well, why don't we do a movie of that? Isn't that
well? There are people talking about doing that. There are people talking about doing that.
I'd love to see that. Or why can't someone publish that book that manuscript? Be fascinating.
Well, he just gave it to me in confidence, wanted me to do an edit of it, and I had it with me when he was killed. You know,
right? I know. But didn't someone also say to John, can't you just call this some kind of psychosis? Why do you have to call it abduction? Wasn't that part of that whole thing?
Oh, no. There's no doubt what they thought. They had their very narrow prisons functioning. You know, the old Sufi saying that, you know, when a pickpocket meets a saint, all he sees are his pockets.
That's right.
You know, and so that, you know, they couldn't conceive of this in any way. You know, they were classic fourth paradigm scientific logical positivists. You know, that if it, you know, that you know, and the problem is that as Thomas Kuhn has talked about, you know, is that even when they're shown proof, they refuse to believe it because they've gotten themselves so, you know, in all of their highfalutin, you know, claims to objectivity in the need to have scientific proof. I mean, you show them flat out videotapes, you know, that you show them, like, the, you know, the UFOs seen over Mexico City during the eclipse that time, you know, with Jaime Massa.
Yeah.
You know, there are 300 people took photographs and videotapes of these vehicles from like 300 different perspectives, you know, and turned them all right into the government. They've got them all. And yet, you know, there's this deadly silence from the U.S. news media. They just don't. It's considered taboo.
So is something going to change? Do you see something changing?
Their worldview.
Will it change? Do you see it changing the taboo?
Yeah, no,
debating?
It will. It will. It just as I say, it's a matter of progress over the course of our life. You know, that from July of 1947, you know, I was like 2 years old at that time. You know, by the time I get to be 95 or something like that, you know, they will have feathered in enough of this information, you know, that everybody in the millennial generation has seen at least, you know, two dozen major science fiction movies. I mean, everybody's seen Star Trek. you know, both generations of Star Trek, you know, so that there's a certain kind of common acceptance of all of this stuff, you know, in the overwhelming majority of people that are in the millennial generation, you know, are certain that there's extraterrestrial civilization, mainly because they've got an IQ above room temperature, you know, but the older people that, you know, came from the World War II generation and the Korean War generation, it was completely communicated to them that they would be completely ostracized, you know, mm-hmm. if they acknowledged any of this. And they would have been, and they were. You know, so that most people are not adequately courageous, and they don't take on things like this. And so, but the real problem is that they adopt the taboo, you know, and they will actually, you know, get into an argument with somebody, you know, and they couldn't even pass a test on it, you know. It's not dissimilar to, you know, a whole lot of other things, you know.
Well, so at the Contact conference that's coming up this May, where are you going to focus? Because there's so much you can talk about. But
I've got three different things. I'm supposed to do my major keynote address, and then I'm supposed to do a workshop, and then they've got this thing called an intensive that I'm supposed to be supervising. The presentation I'm going to be making is about the Jesuit call back in 2009 for the deep and important discussion that we need to all have of the theological and philosophical implications of contact with an extraterrestrial civilization. It's the very thing that they're calling upon us to do. And that's that. Yeah. So I want to be able to do that, to be able to have this kind of a conversation with people that are there. This is kind of a unique audience that's all going to be available, and so the workshop that I'm going to be doing is going to be reviewing the different planets, the Earth-like planets that have been discovered. You know, reviewing all the data about that, because a lot of people kind of hear it out of the corner of their ear, but they don't pay a lot of direct attention to it. And I'm going to be setting forth the proposition that we talked about earlier in this conversation, that the doorway through which this disclosure is probably going to be made is through this bizarre thing of these additional planets that are all being found. Mm-hmm. Even though you got, you know, UFOs landing, you know, Stevensville, Texas, you got a mile-long triangle UFO flying over the top of the town with hundreds of people seeing it, you know, sheriffs and librarians and teachers and everything else, you know, but they don't want to go there. So,
well, even the Phoenix Lights thing, Lynn Cattai is going to be at this conference, so, you know, it's a whole, you know, there's that whole aspect of, like, another bunch of sightings that have been verified. So
they don't want to go there, because if they go to those things, then they're going to have to acknowledge that for the last, you know, 65 years or year or so, they've been lying to the American public. So they just don't want to do that. You know, you're going to get something like with Obama, where Obama said, oh, all this talk about waterboarding and torturing and stuff like that during the Bush administration, oh, you know, let's not look at the past. Let's all just look forward.
Yeah,
let's just be perspective. You know, I've outlawed the waterboarding now, and so let's not talk about it anymore. And so so that's what they're going to try to do. It works for them, you know.
I guess it will work.
Let's not
talk about
the Vietnam War
and
all the war crimes. Let's not do that.
The exoplanet possibility for disclosure is where you're going to talk about in your workshop.
Yeah, that's going to be the workshop, yeah.
And then the intensive will be about what?
I don't know. I'm going to have to figure that out. they just decided we were going to do these things on Monday, on that long weekend. And they've asked me to figure out what I'm going to do in the intensive. So I've got to talk with them, you know, tomorrow and find out, you know, by intensive, what's that mean? You know, how many people are going to be there? How long do I have? You know, and then I'll figure out exactly what we're going to do. As you can tell, there's enough food for thought here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the paradigm stuff, the worldview stuff is very interesting as it relates to the UFO situation, you know,
as
people build.
I
think it's usually about 3 hours. I don't know. Check with their office. But last year, people stayed the Monday after June 1st to do about a 3-hour intensive with people who stayed around. But I'm looking forward to it. So, thanks, Danny, for you know, going to such great detail about these.
Hey, you know,
in a way, they're
folk. It doesn't take much to get me talking about this.
No, it is probably the biggest question facing humanity.
Sure it is. Sure it is.
And you're right there, right in the center of it. From
I've been very privileged to get to do this. I've had a lot of support from lots of friends, and I just consider it probably the most important single issue, for our human family, because it has such implications, philosophically, theologically, spiritually, technologically, politically. I mean, it's just an astonishingly important subject.
Well, and of course, all the other things you've also dealt with in your career, Karen Silkwood, Watergate, Pentagon Papers. I mean, do they fit in somehow to this same general cover-up or denial?
Well, they all tend to relate to the national security state. This entire endeavor on the part of the national security state bureaucracy, of attempting to, under the guise of protecting the national security of the United States, they're really engaged in this major effort to, establish full spectrum dominance over the planet, to maintain the continued privileged access that they have to the strategic raw materials that they need for their military complex. It's a self-fulfilling, militarist program, and that we as citizens have to do something about this.
And we are, and you are. I mean, what is the best thing we can do as citizens about the whole thing, that's come down? What do you think?
There needs to be a new political party. There needs to be a new natural law political party, that's rooted in natural law principles that undergird our Constitution and resurrect the basic original idealist intentions of the country, and to take our country back from the national security state people that are, are serving the interests of the major transnational corporations.
Well, are you doing that? Are you creating this party, or is it happening?
that's the same question my wife asked me this morning.
Oh, okay.
What's the solution to all this? So I said, and she says, oh, no, are you ready to do all that? I said, to know what the right answer is doesn't mean that, that I have to be the one that does this.
Right.
I just know that's the answer. Yeah. We all have to do it. We all have to be willing to step forward and participate in doing this. It sounds a little like Ross Perot when Larry King asked him, oh, what are you going to do? You going to run for president?
Maybe that's what you got to do.
It's got to be more dramatic than that. It has to be an entire natural law party, And they started having a natural law party. The followers of Maharishi Mahesha Yoga, the TM guy, but they got way too parochial and limited and restrictive as to who was going to be in it. But they had all the right premises going. So I think that the revivification of the resuscitation of the natural law party, but on a much wider scale and much less restricted to the TM people, is what we really have to do.
And of course, that will include Native American rights, which I know you're deeply involved in with your latest project. It seems like
we represent the 9 Sioux tribes of South Dakota, and we're reestablishing the Ocheti, Sekawan, Oyate, which is their 7 council fires and their self-government over the Dakota territories.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much more. I mean, you've had an incredible career and just found yourself in the most amazing places at the right time. And,
well, it's only half done. I've only been getting to do it for 45 years. I got another 40 years or so. We'll finish getting this job done.
Great. No, I'm excited. I'm happy you're going to be there at this upcoming conference. It's always fascinating, your input historically and politically and socially about this question. So
we've been there for the long view.
Yeah. Thanks. So how can people get in touch, or a website for you?
Well, there's a danielpsheehan.com.
Sheehan.
On YouTube. There's a YouTube thing, I guess, up the staff put it up, and there's the website and all that. And then there's the RomeroInstitute.org, which is our public interest group.
Mm-hmm. Right, that deals with the Lakota Sioux.
Yeah, well, that's the actual Lakota project, Lakota People's Law Project. That's one of the projects that we do. But the Romero Institute is the 501c3. This the progeny of the old Christic Institute out of Washington.
Oh, I see. Well, thanks so much for spending this much time and talking and being a part of this program.
You're more than welcome. No, I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to people.
Yeah, no, definitely, and you'll meet a lot of like-minded folks there at Contact in the Desert. Danny Sheehan will be a keynote speaker at the upcoming Contact in the Desert. That is this coming May 29th to June 1st in Joshua Tree, California. You can go to the Joshua Tree Retreat site, Retreat Center website for more information. You could also look on my newrealities.com website. Thank you all for listening. Thanks, Danny. I appreciate it.
Terrific. Great on. Thanks.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. You've been listening to guests on the upcoming Contact in the Desert. Thanks for listening.